Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's a pleasure to welcome back into our studios Dr. Art Seer, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business, and Director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College. He joins us once a month, as you well know, to offer his analysis and perspective on various events both here and abroad. This, however, is not Professor Seer's monthly visit to the program. This is rather one of those more intermittent occasions in which Professor Seer has brought with him a very special guest to the campus of Carthage College, namely a higher education journalist by the name of Mary Beth Markline, and someone who has extensively worked as a journalist and studied journalism, and particularly written with great distinction about issues of higher education, and not just here in the United States, but all around the world. The sort of current state of higher education as it plays out in various nations and cultures. And of course, in this rapidly changing world, changing with technology and other matters where this world is increasingly interconnected, it becomes even more interesting to think about the way in which higher education plays out on kind of a global scale. So we have plenty to talk about. And first of all, Professor Seer, we welcome you back. And for the first time, Mary Beth Markline, we welcome you to the morning show and to
Thank
WGTD.
You. Nice to be here.
Glad you can be here. Professor Seer, explain the program which makes this visit possible.
Well, quite a long while ago, first of all, thank you for having both of us on. Sam and Gene Johnson of S.C. Johnson Company were kind enough to endow, among other very generous gifts to our college, the Distinguished Visitor Program. The idea is to bring in people generally from outside the academy who provide the right sort of personal as well as professional example to our students in particular, but also staff and faculty. Tom Clausen has, and his wife, had a particular interest in devices we might develop to make our fine college more visible in the world, and it was a natural, therefore, that I was asked to help implement this program. It's worked very smoothly. The college is very supportive, let me say, that President Woodward and senior administrative staff at the college have only been positive in dealings with our Clausen Center and this program and others that we run. And so for that reason, especially, things run quite smoothly. And the most important thing is good visitors, and we certainly have one in Mary Beth Markline.
Very good. So explain what you are keeping her busy doing through the course of her visit.
Well, she's visiting with a variety of classes, including communication and digital media, which is kind of the successor to traditional journalism, and that's her background. We'll be heading off this morning to, among other things, meet with Mike Fegley's class. He is from Racine and has a law practice there. He's also developed over more than a decade the mock trial program, instruction, and very competitive tournaments for students who have an interest in following the law. Professor Fegley is sufficiently talented, quite talented. He's a obvious, you know, inspired leader and coach. Our team made nationals last year. We were in good company with Harvard and Yale and Virginia and others, and University of Wisconsin at Madison. It's mostly big universities that dominate these proceedings. And not just in terms of making us more visible, that succeeded with a big bang, but also just in terms of showing the quality of our college. We were in good company, as people used to say. And it really paid off big time. I'm particularly glad she's able to meet with his class, along with a range of others. We'll be having an informal lunch with faculty briefly today, and basically other class meetings.
And your class at the end of the day.
Yeah, a senior seminar in international political economy. We're having a joint meeting, which I think is very creative, that Deborah Usinger, who actually does the work, the administrator at the center, put together. Professor Mimi Yang in Modern Languages, her senior seminar in Chinese, will be meeting with our Political Economy senior seminar.
Very
Thanks
good.
Thanks for plugging Political Economy. Thank you, Ms. Markline.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting, too, as you were rattling off the array of classes that you are are visiting through the course of your time at Carthage, it really points to the broad swath of what you have studied and experienced in your career, that you have something meaningful to say to all these different sorts of classes. So it says a lot about who you are and the kind of things you've done. I didn't know till I just met you this morning that you actually hail from Wisconsin originally.
I most certainly do. Janesville.
Yeah. Tell us more about your experience growing up in Janesville and at what point you became intrigued with the notion of pursuing journalism.
Okay. This is, So I grew up in, I was born in Janesville. My parents grew up on farms in northern, like the Spring Green area, the Frank Lloyd Wright kind of territory. And they moved to Janesville because of the plant. And so I grew up in my dad was at the plant. But then
at the automobile plant.
Yeah, the GM plant.
Right.
And, sorry. And then they didn't go to college, so we didn't really know anything about these kinds of things. But what I like to do as a kid, I think I said this one of the classes yesterday, I'll have you know that I wrote a book when I was in second grade and my mother published it. So a book on Halloween. But I would write poems like you would not believe. It's hard to try to write a poem today. I don't know if I could do it. But, I mean, I just was always writing. Hmm. And then I joined the school newspaper in junior high. And you know, I liked writing term papers more than taking exams and that sort of thing. But I was really shy. I mean, I was pretty introverted. And I was too well, that journalism does that to you. But my husband says I don't talk to people, I grill them. So, I was going to tell you, this is weird for me to be on this end of this thing.
I suppose.
Anyway, my mom saw that I was writing a lot, and I still remember when I was a junior or so in high school, she started to announce to relatives that Mary Beth is going to be a journalist. And it was like, well, the last thing I'm going to do is be a journalist if my mom is going around telling people I'm going to be a journalist. So I deliberately did not take any journalism classes my first semester. And then my second semester, I took Intro to Journalism. And I just still remember the professor talking, and just everything was interesting to me and everything made sense to me. And he was talking, I won't go on about this very long, but WCLO in Janesville and the Janesville Gazette were owned by the same company, I think. Mm. And he talked about how they were grandfathered in terms of how you know, the press had to be independent and couldn't be a monopoly. And that sort. And interestingly enough, that was Professor Hoyt. And by pure luck, last Friday, I was up in Madison at a journalism ethics conference. It just happened to coincide with when I was coming home. And my professor was right behind me. So I told him that story, and he said he remembered me. I don't really think he does, but anyway, it started because I liked to write. And then my first job was up in Wausau, and I was a feature writer, and they had me write two stories the very first day.
Whoa.
And scared the heck out of me. And I'll tell you one other thing. Then at some point, I got hired at Green Bay. They were both owned by the same company. And they hired me. I was a feature writer. Then I became features editor, which my friends and I said I was just the editor of everything, because that just means you. Well, you know, it's kind of like what you have to know a little bit about everything, too.
Right.
But when I went over to Green Bay, I started doing editing, more of the editing supervisory function. And I just really, it's the writing and the reporting and the asking questions that I really wanted to do. So I went back I decided to go to graduate school, went to American University in Washington, D.C., where they had where I thought, well, this is a great opportunity to get, you know, cover Washington, D.C. And that led eventually to my freelancing and getting hired by USA Today to cover higher education.
Right. Very good. I want to talk to you a little bit about USA Today, which, I mean, I so vividly remember when USA Today was first published.
Mm-hmm.
Just the notion of it was really exciting. This, I mean, we just had never seen a paper quite like it.
Yeah, yeah.
And, of course, there are some ways in which it was easy to malign because it seemed, you know, a little too colorful and a little too bullet pointed and so on. But I have read all kinds of great writing and wonderful stories in USA Today over the years. And I think a lot of people have, And I'm very curious to know what the experience. You were there for, I think, 17 years.
Yeah. And longer if you add in the freelance.
But. Right. What your experience was like. I mean, I assume if you were there for that length of time that at least for most of the time you found it as a journalist quite satisfying.
Yeah, it was a really fun ride. And a lot of – there's, you know, every organization has kind of a – I don't know. I look back on all of it fondly, but the news business is changing, and it's one of the reasons I decided that I wanted to focus more on higher education. But it was a really cool experience. USA Today had not yet started when I went to Wausau, but it was on the cusp. You know, it was this thing that was coming. And one of the things that they did at the time was, instead of hiring staff, because they didn't know if they were going to last a day, a week, or a month, so they borrowed staff from their Gannett papers. And that's how I got out. That's how I got on this. I had a temporary gig in Washington where I was did work for USA Today, because they took reporters from all over the country, brought them in. And it made a lot of sense, because what we wanted to do was cover the whole country. Mm. And so, you know, one of the things people talk about Wisconsin is flyover country. But, you know, if you have reporters who grew up in Wisconsin or in Indiana, they can bring a type of knowledge that will be valuable to the newspaper. So basically when I got – they hired me – higher education was something that they cared enough about to have a higher education reporter, and then I replaced somebody who retired. And it was really fun. At first, I was a little timid when I think about it now, because I probably could have done a lot more than I did, but my editors were incredibly willing to let me do kind of whatever I wanted to do. I'm trying to think of what kinds of, you know, I had important stories like Supreme Court type cases too, but a lot of my, I'll tell you what my absolute favorite assignment ever was. I did a story, and it's a way that I managed to, I don't know what, but it was a story about Elder Hostel. Do you know?
Oh, yeah. Of course.
So back when I lived in Madison, I had written a story on Elder Hostel for the Cap Times as a freelancer. And so I knew this program and existed, and I saw that Elder Hostel was trying to get more, I don't know what, but anyway, I saw some ad or something about Elder Hostel, and they were teaching flying lessons, and I thought, my dad has wanted to, you know, has always had this thing about airplanes. So I pitched to the travel editor. I said, hey, can I do a story on this airplane school? Take my dad down there. We go through the course. It's a week-long course. And she said, sure, that's great. So my dad and I and my mom came too. We all went to Arizona and went to this Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University and learned how to fly planes. And it was just a really, really, really fun experience. And
wow.
So I found I feel like I'm a resourceful person. Like I can sort of figure out how to get, if I know what I want, I can usually figure out how to get it.
Right.
It's a hard, I don't know that comes off exactly as I mean it to, but I had a lot of freedom to figure out what I thought were the stories and trends. And they didn't let me go any old place I wanted, any old time I wanted, but they were pretty good about, you know, they felt like the best stories are the ones you do when you're there rather than you're on the phone talking to people.
Right, exactly. I remember one of my most powerful encounters with USA Today was the first time I went to Europe. That would have been in 1990, I think the summer of 97 or 98, I forget. And I still remember walking into a store in Prague to, I don't know, you know, just buy some candy or something or other. And here is the European version of USA Today sitting on the newsstand. And it never had dawned on me that I would be able to walk into a store in Prague and buy USA Today. And that was the first time it really occurred to me that in some respects USA Today probably fancied itself, and to some extent with good reason, as being a paper that represented this country in a way, I mean the entire country, in a way that any other newspaper that is pegged to a particular place, even as expansive a publication as the New York Times, mm-hmm. it's the New York Times, and that's where it's published, that's where it's based.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And it's like USA Today existed for a different reason, in a sense, or with a different sense of journalistic identity.
I think you're right, and I have a bunch of thoughts about that. I've jotted a few of them down, and who knows if I'll remember them. But first of all, I now write, as you know, I'm a graduate student, but I write for University World News, and it's a perfect marriage because I'm writing about University World News, and I'm a student of University World News. And what I'm basically realizing I'm doing is explaining U.S. higher education to the rest of the world. The publication is online, and we've got editors and reporters all over the world, and that's what we're sort of saying, here's what's happening in our country, what's happening in your country.
It's based in London, right?
My editor's in London, and I think it's based in London, but I don't even think there's a – it's a pretty shoestring organization and a very grassrootsy kind of thing. But it's very fun to work for. I also remember the international piece is interesting because back when I was invited, I was one of the people that was selected to come to USA Today for 4 months, and it was called – we were called loaners, which everybody always laughed because it's L-O-A-N-E-R. But it's – you know, it sounds like we're these people who, you know, are hermits or something.
Right.
But anyway, so we were on loan to USA Today, and one of my friends who happened to be there with me had asked about – they had like a little orientation for us, and he raised his hand and said, when are you – this was in 85 or 86. When do you think you see covering the rest of the world ever in the future? And they said, no, this is USA Today. We're going to be USA Today. And that's what we – and it's so completely changed.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I mean, I'm looking at the cover of today's paper. You know, you cannot be not – you have to – news is in – you can't not be. And then the other – one other thing I'll just quickly throw out is one of the funny things about working for USA Today – is that we don't have a home team. I mean, sports is sort of – well, we do. But, you know, sports reporters on most – you know, here at Carthage, the students write about Carthage sports. Janesville Gazette writes about the Packers, the Cougars and the Vikings, Kenosha. Cubs I hear people cheer for here, I don't understand, and the Packers. But so USA Today never had that. The sports reporters were like – had to think of a new way to – do that. And
it
was the same thing with me. You know, I was always looking at things from a national perspective. So the fact that there was a hiccup at the University of Wisconsin-Madison wasn't meaningful unless this was a hiccup that was having a domino of, we had to kind of look at it nationally.
Right.
But the Olympics was the way that the United States kind of took on its sports identity. But so I do think it's interesting how you saw it in Europe and thought about it.
Right. And while it would not have ever been the one newspaper I had to read, but it would be one of two or three that I would absolutely want to read every single day. I would feel like I had not fully experienced the world and didn't fully know what was going on if I hadn't also read USA Today that particular day.
So. Yeah, it was a fun place to work, and it, you know, you're right. It took a lot of flack especially in the beginning. I remember the big joke was, would we win the Pulitzer for the best paragraph? You know, because one of our, you know, part of our thing was writing tight and writing small. But like you say, everybody's got a color weather map on the back of their. You know, I mean, they really did set up some. Models that ended up being adopted by a
right.
lot of different people.
Well, it's as though, as it was put together, they were really astute about the way the world was already changing. And, of course, the world hadn't even fully changed yet.
Yeah.
But it's as though they had a sense of that maybe more than the typical mainstream newspaper did.
Well, Al Newhart will be smiling in his grave here knowing about this, yeah.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with a journalist by the name of Mary Beth Markline, and she specializes in higher education journalism, and we'll be talking in just a moment about sort of the state of affairs in terms of higher education, both here and abroad. I do want to talk to you just a little bit about the state of journalism itself and the fact that, of course, we're in a moment now in which journalism itself feels like it's under siege in some respects. And, of course, even ahead of this current climate in which I think a lot of us feel that quite acutely, We were also talking about an economic climate in which many mainstream news organizations felt very painful constriction and still do. It feels like there are fewer journalists in the old sense of the word, and on the other hand, maybe proliferation of a new breed of journalists that many of whom are probably not even engaged in journalism as we would sort of classically think of that. What has it been like for you as a journalist to, in a sense, live through and work through a period of such profound change, most of which are probably at least largely unwelcome changes for the typical journalist?
There are so many different things that are coming into my head, so feel free to rein me in, and you too, Art.
Okay. Thank you.
We were talking, I'm going to say a big thing, and then I'll try to get more personal. We were talking yesterday, Art and I, about a museum, the Robert McCormick Museum.
Yeah, the First Division Museum.
That
down
it
in
so
Wheaton,
happens that
Illinois.
He was telling me about it, and my gosh, I've been there because I covered a symposium there about the future of news. And some of the things that I remember them saying, and this would have been in the 90s, were things like, and I didn't understand it at the time, that one person said, everything's going to be about branding, which at the time was not even anything anybody talked about. And that's all we talk about now is, you know, what's your brand? We have a new brand. We're branding. So this person talked about how it would be about, you know, the identity. It would be your identity and your, like USA Today wants to, it's like protecting your name, your credibility. But she used that term, and I remember just going, where is she getting this branding idea from? But
what used to be reputation is now brand?
I think that's about what it boils down to. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's the simple way to describe that. Mm-hmm. The other big thing that came out that I specifically remember was this idea that the more you can select your own news, you know, that there's all these ways you can personalize your news, which I think, you know, you can already tell where we know, you know what I'm talking about. But so you can personalize them. So you're watching something and you read about heart attacks and you want to know what the 7 signs of a heart attack are. So you click on a link and there you get this whole thing about, and you can even click to another link and see a video on heart surgery. You know, so I remember this guy talking about this kind of stuff. And, but the danger, and it's all very cool, but the danger is people are looking only at what they're interested in looking at. Yep. And that is not what newspapers as a democratic tool were. You know what I'm trying to say. I'm just not saying it very well. But that's a problem for democracy because the whole idea of a newspaper is that you'll see the thing you want. You'll see the comic section, but you won't be able to avoid the fact that there's also something about what the president did yesterday or what happened at the city council meeting, that sort of thing. So this idea of narrowing down your focus, we see it all the time.
And right. And it's so ironic because, in a sense, the tools that are now available to us wouldn't necessarily have to be used in that way. And probably some people don't use them exactly in the way that you describe, but I think you're right, the vast majority of people do, that we live in a world now where the whole world is at our fingertips.
Yeah.
But in a sense, nobody's interested in the whole world. People are interested in what they're interested in.
Yeah.
And so if anything, in this world where the whole world comes into our laptops, we're just reaching out to these slivers of the world, and not seeing the whole picture necessarily, or with the same clarity that we might have once upon a time when you just picked up a weighty newspaper like the New York Times and read it start to finish. I mean, that was really a way to experience the world and all kinds of things you didn't think you were even interested in.
I could go on about so many different things, but what two thoughts right off the top of my head is a lot of people. You know, Facebook now, a lot of us get our news, and I'm become increasingly part of that. You know, I know a few people who are pretty reliable about posting stuff that would be of interest to me. But people have said, you know, especially after Trump became president, I don't want to, you know, I can't take this anymore. I'm getting off Facebook. But I feel like I'm kind of grateful that some of the people that I'm Facebook friends with, like high school classmates and stuff, have a different political point. I mean, that's the way you find out that there's you're not the only, your opinion is not the only one. You look like you might want to say something.
No, it's the interplay between the media and the rest of us. I actually didn't, but thanks for the opportunity. The interplay, it changes, it makes it possible to be more self-centered. I don't want to offend anybody, including the people in the studio here, but there's something that seems very narcissistic about Facebook, especially if you become quite fanatical, as undergraduates in particular tend to do. At the same time, the average person has available literally a world, a universe of information and misinformation and important facts and baloney and trash and all kinds of important new developments. The challenge, I guess, is not to become too self-centered and also to learn how to be selective.
Yeah.
In this massive...
Or be, as I said in one of the class, you know, be good, I don't like the word consumers of mass media, but be good, be critical readers of mass media.
Yeah. You said that in the communications class, but also in the criminology class, and that's a good point worth repeating to undergraduates.
Oh, I'll remember that.
I realize I'm getting old. At least I'm not getting jaded, thanks to being around young people all the time, but... There's something a little disturbing in a way. I almost ran into a young woman on campus drive a few months ago. I still remember it vividly. I was going very slowly, and on my left, there was something about her that was disturbing. She was obsessively going at her cell phone and suddenly threw up her arms and stepped right in front of my car. And I had the sensation of my bumper brushing her skirt. I mean, I almost got her. Thank God I was only going 15 miles an hour. Utterly oblivious to this near encounter. She just blithely went on intensely. There's something kind of disturbing about that beyond the fact that you might get run over.
Right. So that's, in a sense, that's a metaphor for the way
a lot
of people are moving through the world, engrossed in whatever they've chosen to be engrossed in. And
I don't know how clear that is, but it really is a significant change. And if you're fortunate
one of the big moments at back at you at talking about USA Today again, a big moment, I think, for many of us was when they started putting you could put comments on the bottom of your readers could comment on the bottom. And nobody knew that it was going to turn into this polarized, this anonymous source, just nasty, nasty, nasty stuff.
Yeah.
And it was really, I mean, we debated that. We had meetings about that. I don't know if we could change any minds or not. But, it just, I understand the concept behind it. But all these people hiding behind anonymous, and saying just incorrect things, and mean things. And I actually, one story I wrote, this poor woman, it was a single mom who had been on welfare, who went back to school and was graduating, and it was a Mother's Day story. She was graduating on Mother's Day. It was supposed to be this happy story. People just wrote the nastiest stuff. And after that, I started telling my, I said, don't read the comments. If you're in my story and you don't read the comments, they mean nothing. Anyway, so that was a big moment when that all happened. And then, as we all know, the whole issue of clickbait, became important. Now that we could measure who's reading what, we could see that, only three people read my story and a million people read the story about Britney Spears, or she's not even, hot anymore. But, once that started to happen, it became easier for the bean counters, basically, to, favor the stories that got the hits. And it felt like we were making some, not just USA Today, but everybody was really having to make some hard decisions about how they were going to handle that. And then now we've got Trump with this whole idea of fake news, which we can talk about if you'd like.
Right. Well, he
really personifies the coarsening of the culture. No disrespect to the office. Was very successful in securing, but a man who behaved like him not too long ago would have been considered unacceptable. I show my students videos. They're also audiovisual. I accommodate that, but get even by showing old stuff, executive suite from the 50s, I commend to everyone. I showed the first Kennedy-Nixon debate regularly to IPE classes and others. And a regular comment now is, gee, they're so polite to each other. They speak at length, and they don't insult each other. And I make the point as dramatically as I can. Well, in 1960, a man who behaved publicly the way Donald Trump behaves would not be considered a man. He'd be considered something else, quite unattractive and negative. That kind of behavior was just unacceptable. And to me, that's kind of a personification of how things have changed.
Yeah.
They've changed. I don't want to sound too grumpy and old, but they've certainly changed.
I know, I
in
could
the
be
public
grumpy
space,
and old, too, if you want.
In the public space, these comments you're referring to, that kind of behavior in public would not have been acceptable until fairly recently.
Yeah. And wouldn't have been possible. That's part
yeah. It's not only crude. It's not only crude. It's potentially dangerous.
Right.
Men are dangerous at one level, and I don't want to go off on a tangent, but it's extremely important for society to control the ugly side of human nature generally.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's of course part of what we're talking about here is that there are these tools now by which people can act on and communicate the darker corners of their nature, and it's. Not that these are brand new attitudes, but we now have tools by which people with the touch of a button, the click of a mouse, can communicate that to all kinds of people and anonymously to boot. And it's little wonder that we're kind of seeing this darker side of ourselves. It's not that wasn't there before.
Yeah.
We just never saw it. It wasn't into the public sphere.
No, it's always been there.
And the challenge for journalists, when I taught journalism in Romania, it was 2004, so their press was just a little bit, it felt to me like it was the yellow journalism phase that they were kind of in. And it's funny you mentioned the USA Today, because one day I was walking past a newspaper stand and saw a newspaper that was laid out exactly like USA Today, but it was Romanian.
Highest form of flattery.
Yeah, it was interesting. But I would tell my students there, you know, journalism is this essential piece of democracy. Thomas Jefferson said, I'd rather have a world without government than a world without newspapers. But there's the bad side, and then there's the really ugly side of this democracy. And I feel like I was so smart, because look how awful things are now.
One of the things I want to ask you about is whether or not, although this feels like a wrenching time for most serious journalists, and I think many serious journalists feel like not only is it a difficult time, but we're on this downward slide that's irreversible. And I mean, it's sort of hard to imagine a scenario in which the situation will get better, and certainly it's probably preposterous to think that somehow we're going to turn this around and the life and work of journalists will return to what it was 30 years
right,
ago, for instance.
Right, right.
That being said, do you see the potential for some kind of benefit, particularly when it comes to the matter of mainstream journalism being under siege and certain facets of mainstream journalism at least being deeply mistrusted by a fairly significant part of the population? Is it possible that this is a moment of, in a sense, maybe entrenchment or an awakening of appreciation and understanding for what all of this is about and how important it is?
I think I know what you mean. And as a journalist, I totally see what you're saying in terms of I feel like most journalists have, of all levels, have sort of, their resolve is even stronger that they're going to do what we're supposed to do, which is to challenge the government and to ask questions and to not accept things on face value and that sort of thing. One of my favorite, I mentioned this yesterday to somebody too, that one thing that I'm seeing with coverage, covering Donald Trump is this whole new thing. Like this conference I was at the other day, the Washington Post reporter talked about how they discussed, well, do we write about every time President Trump tweets? Should we write something? Or, you know, is that a distraction? There's all these questions. So they've come up with a plan that they're going to every week sort of say, here's what the president tweeted, and here's the facts behind whatever it is he's saying. But the other thing that's happening is we're covering, we, by which I mean journalists, covering Trump very aggressively, I think. And it reminds me of Watergate. And I was... I went into journalism. Part of my journalism thing was also post-Watergate. So, you know, it was like, oh, they do good things.
They're the heroes.
Yeah. So there's some of that's kind of coming back, at least within a certain community. But then I talked to somebody, you know, and I'm really proud, and I feel like, you know, the Washington Post is coming up with something, and then the New York Times is building on that, and then the Wall Street Journal has a little something, and then USA Today comes in. That's really cool to see journalism working together in that, competing. I mean, it's very capitalistic, you know, competing to greatness, whatever, high quality. But then I run into somebody who says, you know, I think the press is really being rough on Trump, unnecessarily rough, they said. And I, you know, it's like, well, I can kind of see why you think that, but in my DNA as a journalist, it's like we would have done this no matter who it was. There's some people who I think would not agree with what you're asking.
Sure. Well, that prompts something I want to say also, which is, although, you know, I don't state my own political leanings all that publicly and almost never over the air. But I guess I have to in this moment. I want to preface what I'm saying by saying that I consider myself a moderate who leans liberal. That being said, I feel like one of the consequences of this environment in which we're in is I find myself much more aware of my own bias and the bias of many journalists, which I'm beginning to see more and more much leans left. And I feel like I'm not just buying into what other people are saying from the far right, but I'm being much more honest about that with myself and with all that I read. And I wonder if you also feel like this is a moment where some legitimate concerns about bias of the media can at least be reflected upon and to some extent addressed, or do you really think that is not the case, that
no,
those charges are unfounded?
I don't think I've thought about it to the extent that you have, but I brought up this conversation the other day because it was kind of a startling. I realized that just saying no, we're not, you know, the media is doing what they're supposed to, is not a good enough answer, and so
in my mind, anytime the answer is quick, the chances are it's not a good answer.
Yeah, my gut reaction was a gut reaction. Yeah. One thing that I have kind of discovered, and this is through graduate school actually, because I feel like I'm kind of straddling this line between journalism and scholarship, and I sometimes don't know which side I'm on. You know, all this kind of stuff. And one of the classes that we had to take was ethics in higher education, and the final paper had to be on sort of what is your personal ethic. And I kind of came to this honesty and transparency. If I ever find myself in an ethical bind, I be transparent, you know. And I'm not saying that's going to save me every single time, but it. Something I can hang my hat on. And now I'm going to be really obnoxious and say, I have never, as a journalist, I've never been public about my politics, with one exception. My brother's running for city council in Janesville. Today's voting day. And he's the best man for the job.
Right. There you go.
Fair enough.
You may get a tweet about that.
Yeah,
there you go. One of my favorite examples of journalists, mainstream journalists, perhaps being biased, it goes all the way back to the days of Tanya Harding, the infamous figure skater who, you know, involved in that controversy. And I still remember an interview that Connie Chung did with Tanya Harding's mother, trying to talking about their background and childhood and so on. And
she attacked another skater? Is that not
right? Well,
Tanya Harding,
people close to her did.
Right.
Yeah. She insisted that she was not personally involved in the attack.
That was incredible.
But the point is, the interview with her mother, Connie Chung, at one point says, "I understand that you physically abused Tanya as a youngster." It said, "Well, I occasionally swatted her on the bottom, so you physically abused her," and she came right back. "I swatted her on the bottom." I mean, in her mind, to call swatting your daughter on the bottom physical abuse, that says something about her, and it says a lot about Connie Chung too. That in her mind, the two are the same, and it's a reprehensible way to behave toward your daughter and so on. And that's the way she saw it. It's not the way everybody's, frankly, it's not the way I see it.
Yeah. The celebrity newscaster who wants to be the news. The celebrity newscaster. That's a television phenomenon more than anything.
Sure, but I think it speaks to a bias, it seems to me, that she was completely unaware of, that there is another way to look at that or to characterize that. And I feel like that is an example, I mean, of a fairly inconsequential matter, but I think that plays out all the time in all kinds of different issues and questions.
You know, it's going to be interesting to see how journalism does evolve because, you know, when I was in school, it was all about objectivity, get both sides. Well, first, you know, first of all, there's not just both sides. There's like a billion sides.
Sure.
But then when I started teaching journalism, I said, you know, it's not so much, you know, we used to talk about objectivity, but now it's makes more sense to think in terms of fairness and balance and trying to make sure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even today, fairness and balance is a question because I was just reading something. I don't remember where, what it was, but sort of a criticism of journalists, maybe it was this ethics conference, false equivalencies. Like, is it, is there another, this is challenging to talk about, you know, but Trump, is there another side to his, are there two sides to climate change, you know?
Right.
And this was when I used to write stories, one of the most challenging stories I ever wrote about was when the school board in Kansas, when Kansas, said you couldn't, didn't have to teach evolution or something like that. And I went to Kansas and I tried to talk to people and there was just no point of connection, no way to, you know, and for me, it was really stressful because it was like, I could never, I don't want to say let my guard down, but I could never just relax. It just, you just never knew what, so all of a sudden fairness and balance doesn't really sound quite right either. And then this issue of truth, is there more than one? And academics, that whole thing is, you know, how do you know what you know and what is true? So it's really opening up all kinds of different challenges, none of which I have all the answers for, obviously.
I suppose nobody does.
Yeah.
But in a sense then, what an exciting time to be a journalist. There are, in a sense, in some ways shrinking opportunities and in other ways, you know, burgeoning opportunities. And of course, a lot of those opportunities don't pay.
Well, one of the bigger concerns in terms of college students, and I mean, one of the things that you start to notice after a while is that young people get hired for less money and they'll do what they're told to. I don't like the way that sounds, but they're eager and they're excited and they want, you know, and some of them are motivated. This is a gross overgeneralization, but, you know, a lot of I've heard the motivation was, you know, they want to be on TV. They want to be a celebrity, or they think that it's glamour, which it's not. Everybody knows. So I do worry that the fundamental principles of, and this is something back to what I think you brought up earlier, the fundamental purpose of journalism is the thing that I'm most worried about and the thing I'm most proud of, what we're talking about, you know, the thing I'm most proud of today when I see what journalism is supposed to do being done, if that makes any sense.
Right. I couldn't agree more. Well, in the last 5 minutes, let's talk about higher education throughout the world. how ridiculous does that sound? Do you want to go first? Seriously, although literally that's the time that remains to us, so that's my fault for getting off on the journalism thing, which is, I think so too, but so is higher education. So you are, of course, someone who has studied the way higher education plays out both here in the United States and abroad. Summarize what you have seen as maybe the most striking trends in terms of how higher education is functioning and the purpose that it's serving.
What I'm going to do is take your question and turn it into what I want it to be, which is practicing my next presentation to a group of business major students, which is...
We're interested in business law.
Yeah.
Business,
the thing that got me interested in this whole international stuff was this idea that the United States was now starting to recruit students from overseas, and it brings it. it brings up all kinds of controversies and things that people don't really misunderstandings and just all kinds of things. But I was in one of the most fascinating things for me, and it again, this is when I'm starting to say, I think international higher education is really interesting, and I'm going to study it even more. And so some of the stories I wrote moved in that direction. But I think one of the most interesting things about this recruitment thing is, the financial role it plays for universities, and that, how local communities feel about Chinese students, for example, taking spots that they think would go to their could go to somebody from their hometown, which, I mean, there's all kinds of different rationales and arguments for all of these things. I mean, now we've got Trump making it harder for students, or scaring students off, which I have not done any stories on yet, but I've got, gathering string on the whole thing. So for me, though, one of the most interesting pieces is I went to Indonesia to a recruitment fair, and it was a federal government-sponsored recruitment fair. But it was, for the longest time, these were run only by the State Department. And it was, the State Department is cultural appreciation and people-to-people and mutual understanding and all this kind of stuff. And they had very clear rules and guidelines about what you could or couldn't do as a recruiter. The one that I went on was with the Commerce Department. And so you start, your first clue is, they're starting to think about this as a business, what the business of recruiting and what is the value. And the main thing that the guy who I was accompanying talked about was, the world is becoming increasingly global. If we get some students from Indonesia at our universities and they move back home, then that's better for us to do business there. And all of these kinds of things. But there then some ethical and moral questions come in terms of how you recruit these students. And the State Department has its rules, and the Commerce Department has a different set of rules, and they don't always agree. And so that's where I've kind of – that's not exactly where I focus, but that's I'm kind of interested in how the United States, which is the top dog in global rankings, at least the way they measure them today – how it is influencing, for better or worse, higher education and development in other countries.
Yeah. Oh, that's.
So I didn't answer your question, but I told you what I'm trying to do.
Well, no, I mean, but that's one of the trends that's, in a sense, most remarkable and kind of occupying your time. And that's of interest to us since, of course, Carthage, like most colleges and universities, is engaged in some of that as well, and have been enriched by it in a number of different ways, and it's fascinating to think about it in sort of a wider picture. And
I love just the whole cross-cultural aspect of what I've been able to do. That's been very rewarding.
Absolutely. Well, this has been an absolutely terrific opportunity to at least touch on a couple of facets of all of the different things that you're doing, and I hope this second day of your visit to Carthage will be just as enjoyable as yesterday was. And
I think it will.
And with all that stretches ahead for you, I wish you nothing but more fun and more meaningful work and more excitement as you've already experienced and shared with us today. Thank you so much for being
here.
Thank you.
This was nice. Thanks.
To be on the other end of the
table. Yeah,
on the
other end of the thing.
Mary Beth Markline, higher education journalist and a Johnson Distinguished Visitor to the campus of Carthage College. And Dr. Art Sear, her faculty host, the director of the Claussen Center, thank you so much for being here as well and for helping to make possible this this morning show conversation.
Thank you. I also want to thank our colleague, Professor Paul Ulrich, who works with us on this program and identified Ms. Markline.
Very good.
As a good visitor.
Great. Well, thank you again for being here. It was fun to talk with you.
Great. Thanks.
Tomorrow on the morning show, two musicians. One will be Matthew Udry, the most recent winner of the youth competition of the Racine Symphony, playing the cello with them this coming weekend. We'll also talk with David Newman from Beloit College, who is the piano soloist with the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra this weekend. And on Thursday, a historian from Waterford